those things are worthwhile, but you get the picture. Churches, they just don't know what to do with millennials. They don't know. I'm a millennial, by the way. They don't know what to do with us. We're this anomaly that they haven't seemed to been able to reach out to or connect with, or at least they don't think that they are. And they do it in all these different ways that culture tells them to do it, and everybody seems to be a little bit lost on it. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Who are millennials, and what do we do with them? What appeals to them? What's the problem with millennials? Is there a problem with millennials? And how can the church be effective in reaching this generation and utilizing this generation? Because I'll end with this as well. Understand that if you are in the 45 to 55 demographic, millennials will be there in 20 years, right? Where you are now, we will be. If the church doesn't engage millennials now, then in 20 years, when they need to be filling the positions that you are currently holding, we won't be prepared. So we're going to talk about this today. Now, again, I am a millennial, and I have a fully integrated Apple system here. I have my phone, I have my iPad, and I have my computer all working in beautiful synchronicity to make this a wonderful experience for you. Here's where we're going to start. Who do you think millennials are? How many of you in here think you are millennials or know you are millennials? All right, so we've got a decent group. How old are the oldest millennials? Mid-30s. Can anybody give me a year? Huh? Okay, so they start in 80, and we'll get to that. So how old would that make the oldest millennials right now? 35 or 36. How about the youngest millennials? Where does the generation end? We'll find out in a second. What are some positive qualities that you've heard about millennials? What are some things we're good at?
Technology.
Technology. All right. We're fully integrated. What else? Well, you can't get to the next question until you give me some positive feedback. What are we good at?
Learn quickly.
We learn quickly. Usually, things don't have too steep of a learning curve for us. All right, we'll move on. What are the negative qualities of millennials that y'all have heard? Say again.
Highly distracted.
Self-centered. We change too much. Not grounded in anything. Entitled. Lazy. Delaying maturity. Delaying adulthood. All of these things come up when we talk about millennials. And it's not that we're the first generation people have accused of. It's just the whole culture seems to have kind of become unified in accusing us of these things. It's okay to say these things of millennials. What are some effective ways to get millennials into discipleship opportunities? What?
Put it around a justice issue.
Hey, that's a good one. You get a gift card for that. Here you go. Oh, who do you want to get this gift card? Miss Becky here, you will get this gift card on his behalf. If you would, fill out that card and give it to Mr. Joey here so he knows who got that. See, now you're paying attention. You can get something if you answer a question. Or you can gift something if you answer a question. So put it around a justice issue. What else?
Invite.
The personal, personal invitation. Not necessarily just blanket invitation. What else? Use Facebook. Now, we'll talk about that. It is helpful to use Facebook. The question is, how effective is it really? Because views and attendance are two different things. So I don't think, in general, what used to work doesn't seem to work anymore, right? The general idea that people used to have that you just came to church because it's what you do, that has gone by the wayside. That actually went by the wayside with the baby boomers. So we can't get all of the blame for that. But in general, that doesn't work. And in general, guilting people into it doesn't work the way that it used to. We have to come about this from a different angle. We have to look at it in a different way. So first of all, let's look at who millennials actually are. Who do the experts say that millennials are? This is wonderful because one of the things we'll learn is millennials hate labels. And so when the experts label us, they're like, whatever, you don't know who we really are. But here's how we're defined. Born between 1980 and 2000. Those are the bookends. So your youngest are 15, your oldest are 35. We fall in that range. That means that the youngest millennials are now about halfway through high school. The oldest millennials have been in the workforce for over a decade. As a generation, we are 20% larger than Generation X, the generation that came before us, between the baby boomers and the millennials. The statistics say that 55 million Gen Xers were born in the U.S., 66 million millennials were born in the U.S., and within about 3 years, the number of millennials in the U.S. through immigration and different things like that will rise to be about 81 million, meaning in about 3 years, we will outnumber the baby boomers. We will be the largest generation in America in about 3 years. That's the estimation. So we're bigger than Gen X. Now this plays out in a particular way because one of the things we're accused of is delaying getting jobs, not like the generations that came before us. What is neglected in that statistic is that the generation that came before the baby boomers was tiny. The silent generation only had about, I think it was 36 million people born in the U.S. into that generation, whereas the baby boomers were up in the 60 million. So what you had was a workforce that was burgeoning after World War II, lots of positions being created, and not a lot of people filling those positions already. So when the baby boomers got out, people like my dad, they had 7 or 8 job offers waiting for them when they got out of college. One of the other things that we'll talk about is how educated we are and how that plays into it. But then as Gen X comes in, they're able to fill in the gaps that the baby boomers haven't filled in because they're a smaller generation. And now you have millennials coming into a workforce where the baby boomers have not yet retired and all of these positions are already filled. The Gen Xers, to some degree, are still in the entry-level positions and there's not a lot for us to get into. So those people who have tried to get jobs have been unable to get them in larger numbers than in previous generations, and we're being blamed for being lazy when in reality the job market is not supporting what is going to be the largest generation in America in a few years. So some of us are lazy, I will admit that. But there's other factors going on into the things that we've been blamed for. We are the most skeptical generation born in the 20th century. Pew Research did a poll in 2013 asking the simple question, yes or no, other people in general are trustworthy. They did that by generation. They broke the answers down by generation. Baby boomers were up in the 40% saying, yeah, in general, other people are trustworthy. Gen Xers were about 38%. Millennials, 19%. 19% of millennials who responded said, in general, other people are trustworthy. We are a skeptical generation. We go into almost every, just generally speaking, we go into every encounter with a bit of skepticism about what people are trying to pull over on us. It's a really interesting thing about millennials in general. Our lives are fully integrated with technology, just like you said. I was born in the year that Nintendo came out. I have not known life without video games. Millennials in general haven't known life without video games. And we have sort of been on that curve where we've just been coming of age as the technology got more and more advanced, and we just integrated it into our lives as it became more advanced. So that 90% of millennials have internet access through their phones. That's the versus like when you get into the silent generation, our grandparents, that number is down in like the 40 percentile. Our lives are just fully integrated with it, and every time something new comes out, we just morph to fit it. And that's the way that we are. In many ways, we're the most ambitious generation of the 20th century. One of the really interesting polls that was done recently was how well we perform on tests versus how well we think we perform on tests against other countries in the world. Now, you may have heard, I mean, the U.S. is like 17th in math and 20th somewhere down in science in the world. But man, we think we're third or fourth. Millennials in general have extremely high self-esteem and an extremely high opinion of what we will be able to accomplish. So in that sense, we have a lot of ambition and we have a lot of self-confidence. The problem is that as we get out of college, what we think we're going to realize in the real world is not coming to fruition at the rate that we think it's supposed to happen. In general, A lot of millennials have grown up with parents who were fairly successful. At least the middle class really burgeoned with our parents and kind of shrunk more recently. But there's this particular standard of living that millennials have grown up with based on what our parents have provided. And when we get out on our own, in general, we think we're supposed to be able to maintain that level. And it doesn't occur to a lot of people that it took our parents 20 or 30 years in the workforce to get there. And that's why millennials also carry an average of about $10,000 in credit card debt. That's just the way it works. And not to mention being strapped with student loan debt. And this is the one that's most important for us. We distrust organized religion and have the largest group of what are called the nuns of any generation in the 20th century. The nuns are people who say, I don't identify with any religious organization at all. 36% of millennials do not affiliate with any religious organization at all, compared with about 19% of baby boomers. We have a huge, over a third of us, don't want to be associated with organized religion. It doesn't mean that they're not spiritual or religious. It doesn't even mean that they're not Christian. But we don't like to identify with these groups because of our skepticism and generally because of what we perceive these groups are really all about. So the question for us as a church is, how do we shrink that group? How do we reach out to that group, get them to understand what Christianity is really all about, and pull them into our groups so we can minister to them? That's the real question. On the one hand, it's a great problem. There's tons of us that we can do it for, right? There's 36% of millennials that we can reach out to and try to get this way. It's a large mission field. The bad side is we have built up a lot of barriers to keep people from being able to do that. So that's our question today. How do we reach millennials? So finally, who are millennials? Who do you think they are? Here's some interesting things just as we go through and talk about who we really are. First, we've been allowed an extended adolescence. There is a new thing. It was actually coined by a guy named Jeffrey Arnett in an article in 2000. He was describing the end of the Gen X generation and the beginning of the millennial generation, and he coined this term called emerging adulthood. Emerging adulthood is the time period between when a person turns 18 and a person turns 25 when society basically expects nothing of them. That's the way he said it. He says it in all this academic language, when the social norms are basically forgotten and nothing of value is expected from this group. Basically, what it means is it's not that the sociologists are saying this should be allowed. It's saying society is allowing this. That for an additional 7 years past when you're allowed to vote and the law says you're an adult, for 7 years past that, society is saying you're really still a kid. And we really don't expect you to be doing the things that an adult does. So college, that's a time to explore. It's a time to discover yourself. It's a time to go and backpack through Europe and spend a whole bunch of money and rack up a whole bunch of debt. But man, when you hit 25, if you're 26 and you don't have a job and you're not contributing, then you're lazy. Right? There's a disconnect there where society says, up to your 25, we understand you're growing in your personality. Your brain is still developing. We don't expect anything of you. But then the moment that ends, it's, man, why aren't you doing something? You're lazy for not being part of this. You're lazy for not having a job. You're lazy for going back and living with your parents again. And it's sort of this weird societal limbo that we are part of. Now, I'm not doing the thing where I'm blaming everyone else for our problems. There are a lot of lazy millennials. There are a lot of us out there. But that's not the whole picture. We've been saddled with this particular idea, and it's not the whole picture. We are a result of what are generally the helicopter parenting, the participation ribbon culture, whatever you want to call it. In some sense, we are... This will sound really bad, but let me explain. We are a failed social experiment. Here's what I mean by that. In the 60s and 70s, when our parents were learning to be parents or getting into adulthood themselves, a lot of psychological studies were coming out that said the way you ought to parent is this more kind of offhand approach. You should be your kid's friend rather than a parent. Don't tell them no. Always use positive language. I read an article even today. I have a three, she's almost three, and we're in the middle of really getting her potty trained, and I read an article today that said Potty training is mentally debilitating for your kid. It's something that they should learn to do naturally, and you should invite them to participate. Never use negative language like stinky or messy or whatever. Let them tell you when you're ready. You know what you get if you do that? You get poop all over your floors. That's what you get if you do that. But that is the mentality that was beginning in the 60s and 70s that parents or parents-to-be were learning, and they did that with us. Right? Never make them feel bad. Always be careful about their self-esteem. Tell them they did a good job, even if they didn't. Don't ever fail them. My mom is a teacher. She's not allowed to give students failing grades in the first 12 weeks that they're in school. Because the idea is if they fail in the first 12 weeks, they've given up for the whole school year and you'll never get them back. So you have to pass them. Right? That's the mentality that has been put on us. We've grown up in that mentality and we've inhabited it, right? My favorite story that I tell about this, I taught math, and I had a girl who took a test one time, and on a free response problem, she wrote down all stuff all over the page, and none of it was right. None of it was even remotely close to being right. I mean, I looked at everything she wrote, and I gave her no credit on the problem. When she came back with the test, she said, "Why didn't I get credit on this problem?" I said, "I looked at everything you wrote, and you didn't know what you were doing. Nothing in your work even remotely begins to go in the right direction to answer this question." And her response was, "But look at all the stuff I wrote." Her expectation was, because I did something, I get some credit, even if it's not at all right. This is the mentality that we have inhabited. It's a mentality that our parents have raised us in. So again, it's not our fault. We got to grow up. We got to get out of this mentality. And yet it's sort of the social structure that we have grown up in. And it shouldn't be a surprise that we live the way that we live. This is the way that parents have raised us. So all of that to say, when you're dealing with millennials and there's all these negative stereotypes about us, it's worth looking at the big picture just a little bit more and then saying, okay, how do we get past that in order to actually get a mature Christian out of this person? We're the most educated generation in history. Over a third of millennials already have college degrees, right? Because most of us are out of college by now. We're just past the halfway point where just less than half are not yet out of college and just more than half are out of college. One of the side effects of so many people having a degree is that a degree has become less valuable. And so what happens is a lot of millennials are continuing their education into a master's degree or into some sort of certification, and it's delaying our entry into the workforce. Again, that's just reality. That's the way that it is. We have very positive self-images. I've already talked about that. We hate labels unless we make them up. Right? Don't you dare label us. I will label myself just fine. And that goes back to the idea of a distrust of organized religion. It is an interesting trend that Baptist churches are taking the name Baptist out of their church because it doesn't appeal to millennials. It doesn't appeal to the younger generation. So the Village up in the DFW area, they were a Baptist church, and Matt Chandler actually renamed them and took the name Baptist out because he wanted to appeal to the younger generation. And the younger generation thinks Southern Baptists are a bunch of 80-year-olds who want to go back to the golden age of the 1950s. So how do we get around that? That's how churches are doing that. We don't want to be labeled Baptists. We want to be Bible believers. We want to be Christians. We want to have our own hashtags. And that's just the way that it goes. But this is what I'm convinced of. We're primed for a spiritual revival. Here's why I think that is. Most generations that preceded us had some major sociological event going on in the middle of their developmental years that they rallied around. You had the World War II generation that fought in World War II. You had the generation that came after them that was really centered around the burgeoning economy and the new education that was available to a lot of people, that more people could go to college. You had the baby boomer generation that had the civil rights movement going on as they were growing up, and they rallied around that. And the Gen Xers had the technological boom, the computer boom that started right around their time that they were able to latch onto. Millennials do not have a cultural event that is going on that we've been able to latch onto. What that allows is that the church can be that cultural event. That the church and the gospel can be that cultural event, because everyone wants something that brings value into their lives. Everyone wants something that they can be a part of that they feel like is theirs and that really builds them up as a group. And the millennials don't have that yet. And I truly believe if we work at it right, that the church, the gospel, can be that thing. Because right now, we're just kind of aimlessly going about things. And we buy into social movements and social justice, and we get behind certain hashtags, but don't really go anywhere with it. And it doesn't have any longevity to it. So that's who millennials are. Let's talk about what millennials are attracted to, and in some sense, where we need to get back to. Millennials want to be authentic and build relationships. Every poll about what millennials want out of church will have these two things in the top three. Mentoring is usually the third. They want people to be people. They don't want to walk into a church and see the veneer of a smile and know that something's going on behind that nobody's willing to admit. And that's why you see this movement towards small groups that live life together and really get into each other's business. And they want to build relationships. We want to connect. We're connected to hundreds of people through Facebook, but we want to make those connections with real people that we think care about us, that show that they care about us. So first we have to differentiate between authenticity and authenticity. What do I mean by this? Let's go with the quotation mark one first. When somebody stands at the door and they greet and they say, "Hi, my name is so-and-so," and you say, "Glad to meet you, we're glad you're here." If that person comes back the next week and you don't know who they are, then you have followed under quotations, authenticity, because you acted like you cared and you didn't care. Now, that's the perception. If you say, you know what, in our life Bible studies, we really get down into the hard life issues, and then in discussion, no hard life issues are talked about, and the discussion questions don't lead to talking about hard life issues, you fall under the second category of people who say they're authentic but are not authentic. You drew us in, you convinced us this is the way it was going to be, and then you let us down. Now, you couple that with the fact that we are the most skeptical generation of the 20th century, and all you're doing is fulfilling the prophecy we hope you're going to fulfill. We want you to let us down. We expect that you will not be what you say you are. And we look for reasons why you are not what you say you are. But if people come in and you say, "Hey, I want to get to know you. I want to know what's going on in your life. I want to pray for you. I want to keep up with you. I want to connect with you. I want us to live in a community together where you use your spiritual gift and I use my spiritual gift and we do this thing together." If you pour into their lives, if you really genuinely show that you care about them through your actions over time, we can be some of the most loyal people you have ever met. Because we don't know where to find this. And if you have it, we want it. And we will not leave as long as we think you have it. Once we connect in that sort of a way, we want to be loyal to that connection. And so if we can come into your life Bible studies, if we can come into your church, and what we find is genuine authenticity, where we are dealing with the hard problems of life together and what it means to fail day after day and yet to get back up and to try to follow Christ again after that. If you give us that, we will plug into that and we will reciprocate and we will be loyal to that. This is what we're afraid of we're getting every single Sunday, that you're telling us what we ought to be doing, and you're not doing it yourself. You're telling us you're going to do one thing, and you do something completely different. We expect that out of church. It's that distrust of organized religion. We expect that. We like to be happily disappointed, right? Not happily disappointed in that we leave, but happily disappointed that you didn't meet our expectation of being fake. I know that that seems really self-centered, but in all honesty, I think it's what the church ought to be. People get really worried about the number of nuns that we have, right? The number of people who don't affiliate. I think we're just being honest. I think that previous generations had just as many people who were not really affiliated, except in name. And millennials are going, "You know what? I'd rather sleep in on a Sunday morning than go and fake it." So in that sense, I think we're just being honest in a way that previous generations haven't. We want to create community where people belong. The two words that I've come to learn about my age group are value and meaning. And here's how that goes. Value is that the time we spend with you is better than anything else we could be doing with that time. Spending our time with you is a more valuable thing than spending it doing anything else, because we have a lot we could be doing, especially in a place like Houston. I mean, think of all the things that people could do on a Friday night or a Sunday morning or a Saturday night that causes them to sleep in on Sunday morning or something like that. All of the options that are available, the clubs they can go to, the parties they can go to, the concerts they can go to, the fun they could be having. What we have to do as a church is say, you know what? That stuff isn't bad, but what you're going to get here is better. When you walk into our doors, nothing will top this, because we can offer you spiritual connection. We can offer you something that nobody else, no concert, no fun party that you can have, nothing that you can go to, nobody else has this. We have it. You want it. Come get it with us. Creating communities where people belong. And then meaning, why do millennials post what they post on Facebook, right? Cool food that we're eating, cool places that we've been. You don't see the person who just got broken up with, like selfie of me crying on the couch after I got broken up. You don't see that. We present this picture of ourselves in the things that we're doing that other people would be jealous of, right? Look at this new foodie place that I've discovered that you didn't know about, but I know about. Look at this cool trip that I've been on. Look at the view off the bow of my cruise ship and all of this kind of stuff. What we're trying to do is say, look at all these experiences that make me me. Right, look at all these experiences that make me an interesting person. In some sense, a millennial's greatest fear is being boring. There's more meaning to be found in a Christian community than in any of those experiences. But we want to feel like when we've done something, we are a deeper, more well-rounded, better person for having done it. And if the church says, come in and sit in a pew and don't talk to anybody around you and listen to a sermon or a sermonette or a sermon light that briefly uses scripture and then convicts you of something that you're doing wrong and then tells you to go fix it, and you walk out the door and nobody cares, that's not meaningful. We don't feel like we've experienced anything. We don't feel like we've grown through that. We feel like we wasted our time. But if they come in and you say, you know what, you belong, we care about you, here is how to be more like Christ, and we will walk along with you in that, and they walk out the door with a feeling that they connected with somebody, that they learned something that can be developed through their lifetime, if you add meaning to what you're doing, it goes hand in hand with that authenticity thing, then we're hooked, because it's what we're looking for. We're looking for value and we're looking for meaning. And then, like I said, under authentic and building relationships, usually mentoring comes up in something that millennials really want. Now, there's an interesting social aspect to this, because most people begin to want a mentor about the moment that they disconnect from their parents. And it's because we've lost that connection with somebody older than us, that really close kind of daily or weekly connection with somebody older than us pouring into our lives and helping us make big decisions that we're afraid to make ourselves. And so we look for a mentor who's older than us, who is adulting just a little bit better than we are, and who can help us answer and address these life issues that we're really scared to face because we've never faced them before. Now, that is where a danger can come in, because a mentor can become a crutch. A mentor, they may just be unplugging the umbilical cord from their parents and then walking around looking for someone else to plug it into. But mentoring done right can be the thing that pushes a millennial out of the immaturity phase and into the really spiritually mature phase. It requires a lot of time and it requires a lot of effort. I can tell you that. Because when millennials really want to be mentored, they're going to ask a lot of questions and they're going to want a lot of time. If you're willing to give it to them in a healthy way, then you're going to bring somebody out of a fog that they were terrified of and into a really spiritually mature place. Now, the second thing is discipling. These two are different. Mentoring is where somebody who is older and wiser and more mature pours into somebody who is younger and less mature on how to deal with life issues and face big challenges. Discipling is the side by side walking together and helping each other, where you're pouring into each other in a particular way to grow as Christians particularly. Now, and that's how I define discipling. And I think that it's a helpful distinction between mentoring and discipling. A lot of people look at what Paul and Timothy did and they call that discipling. I call that more mentoring. Because that's what Paul was doing. He was pouring into Timothy out of his wealth of knowledge to teach Timothy what to do after Paul was gone. Now, I would call that mentoring. You can call it discipling if you want, but I call it mentoring here. Discipling is more of a peer-to-peer thing where I have a little bit more information here, you have a little bit more information there, I'm more mature here, you're more mature there, and it's this two-way street where we're helping each other. That is something else that people want. That's that lateral community that we build with people. So we want relationships with people older than us, and we want relationships with our peers, both of which are pouring meaning and value into our lives to push us forward and to help us succeed. And your job, in particular, can be leading the way. Because most of the people I know who want to be mentored, most of the people I know who want to get into community groups don't have any idea how to ask, don't know who to ask, or they asked somebody that they thought would help, and that person didn't help. Right? They said, hey, I really want to be, they go up to a minister and they say, I really want to be mentored. Do you have anybody? And the minister goes, oh, I don't have anybody right now. Let me look into that and I'll get back to you. And they never get back to him. And a millennial in general is going to go, that's that authenticity that I thought you had. I'm going elsewhere. So you can lead the way by targeting millennials, or those of you who are millennials, targeting those less mature spiritually millennials and latching on to them and seeing if this is something that they're willing to do. Take that first step. And most importantly, you have to be willing to open up. You have to be willing to lead the way and saying, you know what, I struggled with that too. Here's how I overcame that. If this is what you're having trouble with, let me help you with that. It's those sorts of relationships that will really build up. How are we doing? Oh, we're doing great. I'm going to try to get y'all out of here at 11:20. Tapping into the rich potential of a generation. This is, again, where when I said that we are poised for a spiritual revival, and in some sense we're the most ambitious generation in the 20th century. We certainly think enough of ourselves to be ambitious. This is the potential of our generation, and I don't think it's been tapped yet, not in large part. We want to work. We want to work. We don't want to sit around all day. In general, we look at, especially when it comes to spiritual things, we look at what the Bible says and we say, you know, a lot of people are working in the Bible. They don't just come to church and sit and learn. They actually go out and they do stuff. That's what we want to do. And if your church says, that's great, let's sit in the pews and talk about doing stuff, but never actually go do stuff, then you're not going to connect. You're not going to reach them. But if they see you working, if they see you going out into the community and like in Dallas, we just had those tornadoes come through on the day after Christmas and wipe out whole neighborhoods. I think 8 people died. But in general, I mean, people from our church, we had one of our camera guys, the tornado literally like squeezed thinner, went through his backyard, took out all of his fence and half of his roof, and then widened again and destroyed his neighbor's house. It was really crazy. The question is, does the church say, that's too bad, we'll be praying for you? Or does the church go out to his house and reshingle it? There's a big difference between the two in millennials' eyes. Right? We look at the parable of the Good Samaritan and we say, I don't want to be the Levite. I don't want to be the Pharisee. I want to be the Samaritan. I want to go out, I want to do things. I don't want to just talk about it. I want to actually do it. And if the church, whatever your life Bible study or Houston's First Baptist Church or whatever it is, if you talk about it and don't do it, then you're going to lose us. It's just reality. We want to work. Now, we're often accused of being lazy, right? We don't get jobs. We go back and we live with our parents. We don't pay rent, blah, blah, blah. That's true. And largely it has to do with those social factors that I told you about. But because of that, we're just chomping at the bit to work. I mean, I don't know a millennial in my group who is living with their parents who likes that situation. Because, I mean, if you're a guy and you tell a girl, hey, let's go on a date and then we'll go back to my place and watch a movie with my parents, that doesn't go over very well. And it makes you feel stunted in your growth to be in that situation. Most people I know who are in that situation are desperately trying to get out of that situation. And the way they're trying to do that is to find work that allows them financially to do that. But because we're chomping at that bit, the church can dive into that and give us work to do, the work that the Bible calls us to do, caring for widows and orphans, right? That's true religion, according to James. In fact, Francis Chan just has a new series out on Right Now Media about James, but James is one of the favorite books of millennials. Almost every pastor of a mega church has gone through some series on James, or the Sunday schools have gone through some series on James recently, if you go back and you look. Because people like the idea of faith without works is dead. Millennials have really kind of embodied that. One of the things that we emphasize is social justice. If there is a social issue that we are rallying around, it's social justice. That is, people who are in less fortunate situations working to bring them out of those situations. And we want to do that nationally and internationally. That's one of the main focuses that we have right now. Now, there's a danger here, because as we've seen in the last couple of decades, when the gospel is combined with social justice and the focus tilts towards social justice, what you get is called the social gospel. And that is, salvation is found by pulling people out of their poverty and getting them back on their feet. And that is what God has called us to do. That's the social gospel. It strips the gospel of any mention of sin, of any mention of Christ, of any mention of repentance. And it says what the work of the church is to go and to get people out of oppression, to preach and reach the poor, and to get everybody kind of on this equal footing. That especially has happened in Latin America under communist ideas, and it is not working, and it's not the gospel. So you have to be careful when you talk about social justice that you don't just make the gospel about helping people, right? Helping them get more money, helping them get clean water, helping them do all of these things. There's more to it. But when the gospel and social justice are in balance, what you see is the word of God changing people's lives and the people of God working to facilitate that. You see this beautiful combination. That's what young people today are looking for. That's why we're certainly willing to go out and give our time. The difficulty is we're not willing to give our money because we don't have any. And so we'll have to learn that a little bit later. That's the next point. We're going to inherit enormous financial power. The boomers are going to transfer $30 trillion in inheritance to millennials over the next three decades. $30 trillion. Morgan Stanley already knows this, and if you go to their website, you can find a training program on how they're planning to get that money. Right, we will invest that for you, and you will pay us for that. The banking system knows this is coming, and they're already preparing for it. The problem is the church is not. Most of the money that funds these buildings and keeps these lights on are coming from people 55 or older. And millennials, by and large, are not giving into that system. If you mention money, you will lose millennials. I mean, that's just the way it goes. Let's talk about stewardship. Nope, I don't need that. And that's just the way that it goes. People don't like talking about money. Millennials especially don't like talking about money. And yet it is an incumbent upon the church to teach us now what to do with the money that we're going to get in 30 years. How can that money further the kingdom of God? Right? Not in any greedy way, in a stewardship way. How do we do what God would have us to do with the finances that he's giving us? Most millennials, when they inherit money, are probably going to be in debt. They will never have known what it means to live without student loan debt and credit card debt. And they're suddenly going to get this windfall from their parents, and they're going to have no idea how to be responsible with it. They're going to pay off their debt, and then for the first time in their lives, they're going to be able to afford things they've never been able to afford before. The question is that money going to go into the private sector, or is some of it going to go toward God's work? That foundation has to be laid now so that when we inherit that money, we'll be ready for it. And that's what I want to really encourage you with as we finish up. We are a generation worth pouring into. In some sense, I look at my own group. I'm 30, so I'm 5 years into the millennial group. The youngest of us are 15, and there's a part of me that wants to say, you know what, we'll come around in 20 or 30 years. Maybe it's time to just kind of let the millennials do their thing and start focusing on other groups. But again, if you don't do that, we're gigantic, right? We're huge as a generation. And in 20 or 30 years, we are going to be necessary to make the church function the way that it's supposed to function. We're going to be filling the pastorates and the education ministers and the singles ministers and all of that kind of stuff. We're going to be filling all of those roles. If we aren't taught now what to do, we will not be ready when that time comes, and the church will suffer for it. It'll still exist, God promised that, but it will suffer for it. If we're trained now, and if people pour into us now, then we have the ambition and the motivation that we can actually make it better. The question is, are people willing to do the work? And in 20 years from now, are we going to be ready? Now, that being said, the youngest millennials are 15. And I said, in some sense, we're a failed social experiment, right? The church turned the youth groups into big, flashy shows with lots of fun that went to Rangers games and Six Flags and all of these sorts of things. And when people exited that youth group, there was nothing for college students, really, and nothing for young singles, really. And until you were married and on your feet and tithing, there wasn't anything for you in the church. There's this huge gap. And as a result, people stopped coming to church in droves. Huge amounts of people, after they graduated from high school in our generation, just stopped going to church. And it wasn't until we started having kids that we got back. Huge gaps in time where we had no spiritual maturation, nobody pouring into us. So we either come back in having regressed pretty far, or at the very best, we came back in exactly where we had left with no spiritual maturity. That's kind of the way that it went. Don't do that with the next generation. Your 14-year-olds, the people just entering high school, it's an entirely different generation. And of course, these generational cuts don't mean like suddenly there's this mentality shift between people who were born a day after and a day before. It's a gradual thing, but in general, when you get down into those 13 and 14-year-olds, they have a completely different view of the world than millennials did at their age. So take the lessons that you have learned from us. Don't make the same mistakes that were made with us. We need to set up college programs in our churches that reach into the youth programs and prepare them for that shift, that prepare them for what it means to step out and suddenly your faith is your own. And nobody's there to make you go to church. Mom and dad aren't going to wake you up and drive you. You've got to do it yourself. And here's why you should. All right, we've got to reach into those youth groups and we've got to teach them how to deal with real life issues, depression, suicidal thoughts, debt, how to do well with money, how to deal with boyfriends and girlfriends, how to be sexually pure, how to do all of those things. We've got to be real about it so that when they get to college, they don't say, that was great for my parents, but I'm going to go and I'm going to do whatever I want to do. That's what my generation did. We cannot let the next generation follow those same footsteps, because otherwise, in 20 years, you're going to have somebody like me standing right here telling you exactly the same things. Millennials can be great, right? We're not terrible, I promise. We're not terrible. We're in some ways either misguided or we are aimless, and we need to be brought back in through strong spiritual leadership. We are a good generation with a lot of potential, if people will just put the time and the effort in. Now, y'all, any one of y'all who are millennials who are here tonight are the exception to this rule, because you've taken it upon yourself to take a leadership position, to come here and until midnight, and we're going to exit here and eat some cinnamon rolls here in a second, but you've taken it upon yourself to do this. That makes you, on the great bell curve of millennials, pretty far to the right. Reach out to your brothers and your sisters in our age group and teach them to do what you've done. Teach them the importance of it. Be that voice in your generation to make a change. For those of you who are older than us, please don't give up on us. Reach into our lives and help us understand what it means to live like Christ. I think we're poised for an amazing spiritual revival in this country if the church will just do what the church is supposed to do. Any questions? We got about 5 minutes, so any questions? Yeah. Like mm-hmm. So in Dallas, we are a market that has a lot of especially fresh college graduates moving into downtown. Yeah. So in order to reach out to them, and this is a tough nut to crack because apartment life is difficult. It's hard to get into apartments, and we've tried various things successfully and unsuccessfully. There's something new that we're trying now that's sort of mimicking the porch. So do y'all know what the porch is up at Watermark in Dallas? What they have done is successful. What they have done through their series is they've addressed the issues that millennials really care about, and that pulls the millennials out of the apartment complexes on a Tuesday night to go down to this very weird, if you've ever been to Watermark, like it's in a great place in terms of ease of access, and at the same time it's in a really weird place because it's just surrounded by highways. So I guess in some sense it's similar to this church. But people are willing to go down and to brave Dallas traffic to make it to this campus to hear about their current series, Adulting, right? How, I don't know how to be an adult. Teach me what the Bible says about being an adult. When you do that, and you do it effectively the way that Watermark does, where they use social media and they use the outlets that get millennials' attention, then you can pull them out. In general, you have to have something that is viewed as valuable enough, more valuable than anything else they could do. And the only way to do that is to build a reputation. That's what the porch has done over 10 years. They've built a reputation. That's what we're trying to do, is build a reputation for dealing with these issues and reaching into people's lives and meeting them where they are. That is the best way that I know of to do it. Don't sell yourself short. But...
They're trying to repeat and really don't know how to go about luring children back or love them back into all of that. Is any kind of program that this church has for helping those types of parents?
So when you have parents whose kids have been wayward, either in college or in single life, or maybe they're, you know, living with somebody, having kids with people outside of wedlock, all of that kind of stuff. When you're dealing with that in the millennial generation, and it is prevalent in our generation, we're one of the most prevalent cohabitors of any generation. Our senior adult minister is actually planning to start a series helping parents and grandparents bring them back. But in general, you want to avoid the term program, because millennials don't think they need to be in a program. Instead, I think what we have to do is work with those parents to be forces pushing from one side while the church is pulling from the other side. So doing the things that we just talked about, creating programs that are meeting millennials where they are, that will attract them through dealing with the life issues that they're struggling with, that's how the church pulls. And then parents very gently and patiently pushing from the other side, saying, have you heard about this? Have you gone to this? Is this something that you'd be interested in? I'd pray for you about this. And really trying to pour in. Because if it becomes, nobody likes being a project. Nobody likes being a fixer-upper. And so as much as you can avoid making somebody feel that way, while at the same time giving them that firm kind of push in the right direction while the church is pulling from the other side, I think that's your best shot. I think in general, most millennials are going to come to realize over the next 10 or 15 years that everything they've been chasing after for meaning and value don't provide that, and they're going to turn back to what they were used to when they were in the youth groups. I think that's what we're going to see in the next 10 to 15 years. So a lot of prayer, a lot of patience, and a lot of that firm kind of invitation and pushing and meeting the perceived needs that millennials have. Yeah, because the parents alone aren't likely to be able to do it, right? Because the kids have gone off the deep end, even though their parents encouraged them not to. So the parents alone aren't going to do it. The church is trying to reach out, and we're being fairly somewhat successful in that. But if the two work together, you've got the people that the kids know, these people care about me the most, being my parents, and then this church really seems to care about me and helping me deal with the issues that I'm trying to deal with. If you get that tag team going, I think you've got a much better chance. Other than that, it's just a lot of prayer. I mean, really. A lot of prayer and patience. Anything else? All right, well, y'all go. Oh, one more.
So, a lot of your presentation was informed by sociology.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And
So that's a big question in Christian counseling, right? How much of the secular sources should we use in terms of trying to reach people? And there's a lot of different theories on it. My view is secular research filtered through a biblical worldview can be extremely helpful. The problem is that most people do it the other way around. They filter the biblical worldview through the secular research. And they say, well, secular research says that millennials don't like this, so we won't talk about that in the church. Well, if that's a big deal in the Bible, then you can't let that go. But if you take the research and you say, you know what, let's take the biblical worldview and let's interpret that research through this worldview, then it can become very helpful data. Right? Because it's not like the researchers are wrong because they're not using the Bible to reach their results. But there's a danger of relying on secular results without first filtering it through the biblical worldview. So you have to be very careful, but I think it can be very useful to understand all that research that's being done and to sort of redeem it through the biblical standard. All right, I'll go ahead and let you go. If you have any other questions, I'll stick around for a few minutes, but go get your sticky buns.